WMFO, Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there is no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. This morning, I just have a couple of odds and ends I'd like to play. It's not an official grand hour show, even though I'm kind of logging it as such. I'm going to play a little Augusta Van Vine a couple of times throughout the show. We'll start here with that in a second.
The white-eyed vireo is partial to woodlands with brushy thickets. His notes are rapid, emphatic, and staccato. The red-eyed vireo says, "See me, over here, hear me," as he feeds leisurely through the treetops of village or forest. If the birds were to form an orchestra, the mourning dove would be the cello. Thank you.
tried to throw a little Norma Stillwell in there. I've played her and her husband, Jerry, before on the regular Glint Grand Hour. Next, I'm going to play The Final Problem, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, starring John Gielgud as Sherlock Holmes. He starred as Holmes from 1954 to 1955. And this one, if anybody follows the Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle stories, this one was always kind of interesting. I'm not going to reveal what happens. But it guest stars Orson Welles as Professor Moriarty. Orson Welles played Sherlock Holmes, I believe, in a Lux production, The Immortal Sherlock Holmes. I played that 2 months ago on another Tuesday morning. But I forget actually what playhouse did that. I don't think it was his Mercury Theater. It was Mercury Players. But anyway, here we go with The Final Problem. This is Arthur, and you're listening to 91.5 FM Tufts Radio, Medford.
Of Sherlock Holmes. We present the original stories of the late Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized anew with Sir John Gielgud as Sherlock Holmes, Sir Ralph Richardson as Dr. Watson, and today, Orson Welles as Professor Moriarty.
It is with a heavy heart that I come before you with the last adventure of my friend Sherlock Holmes that I shall be able to relate. I have tried in my humble way to chronicle some of our exploits together, to demonstrate the singular gifts of that most remarkable of men. It lies with me now to tell you what occurred between Holmes and his arch enemy, Professor Moriarty, when at last they came face to face.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, your efforts on the side of law and order have seriously inconvenienced me. The situation between us is becoming an impossible one, Mr. Holmes. It simply cannot go on. One or the other of us must die. Must die, Mr. Holmes.
It was in the spring of 1891. You will remember, perhaps, but after my marriage and return to private practice, Holmes and I had drifted apart a little. I followed the newspaper reports of his cases, of course, and called on him quite often at the old rooms in Baker Street. Even so, however, many weeks would sometimes elapse between our meetings. And so, it was with some surprise, one April evening, that I looked up and saw him standing before me in my study.
Good evening, Watson.
Oh, good evening, Holmes.
Have you a cigarette for me?
Holmes, great heavens, man, how ill you look.
Oh, I dare say I've been using myself up rather too freely of late, old friend. You've no objection if I close your window shutters?
No, of course not. You're not afraid of anything, are you?
Well, to tell you the truth, I am, rather.
Well, it's not like you, Holmes. What is it?
Air guns.
Air guns? What on earth do you mean?
There's a new and deadly type of air gun, Watson, which has been specially designed by an old acquaintance of ours.
Who? What, Professor Moriarty? It can only be he, from your tone.
The same. A match. Give me a match, will you, my dear fellow?
Yes, of course.
Oh, thank you. Is Mrs. Watson at home?
Oh, no. She's on a visit to an aunt. Oh, good. Quite alone.
Good, good. That makes it easier for me to propose that you should come away with me for a few days.
Oh, delighted. But where?
Oh, the continent. Somewhere abroad.
Huh? Abroad?
Yeah, is that whiskey in the decanter there?
Yes. Now, look here, Holmes. What's all this about? There's something more serious in your manner than...
You never did quite believe in the iniquities of Moriarty, did you, Watson? You've said so more than once.
I felt you exaggerated a bit. After all, Professor Moriarty is a respectable figure in public life.
Just so, and that's the very genius of the man. Even you, Watson, knowing me as you do, can't quite believe me when I tell you that he corrupts all London with his evil influence.
Oh, I can't quite believe that.
Oh, of course, to the world, he's still the professor, the great mathematician. He's respectable.
But what real proof have you that he's anything else?
None.
Well?
At least, not until this last month. And even now the chain isn't quite complete. But 3 days more, and I shall have him, Watson. 3 days more, if I live to see them.
You can't seriously suppose that your life's in danger, Holmes?
No.
Oh, you always love to be melodramatic.
Melodramatic? Listen, Watson, this morning, this very morning, in those old rooms of ours in Baker Street, I saw him face to face. I spoke to him.
Moriarty?
Your distinguished professor. Within him a criminal strain of the most diabolical kind. That great white dome of a forehead, those hooded eyes, and the white face pushed forward, oscillating from side to side like a snake's.
Oh, of course, if you believe the old heresy of physiognomy...
It isn't only that, of course not. I've worked for years to follow 1,000 different threads, and every one of them has led to Moriarty. He's the Napoleon of crime, Watson, the secret organizer of almost everything evil that goes undetected in this great city of ours. There he sits, motionless, like a spider in the center of its web, a web with 1,000 strands, and he controls them, every one. But slowly, very slowly, my own secret plans to expose him have borne fruit. Every day my net is drawing tighter, and he knows it, Watson. He knows the danger he's in, and that was why today he came to see me. I was playing my violin, as you know I often do when I want to think, and suddenly there he was, standing in the doorway, with his white face swaying in that evil way, peering at me with his hooded eyes.
Good morning.
Professor Moriarty, good morning to you.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, I believe. How very charmingly you play.
How kind of you to say so. Won't you be seated, Professor Moriarty? I can spare you just 5 minutes.
It's singularly good of you, thank you. I will sit down. May I say something personal, Mr. Holmes?
Certainly.
Well, surprised to discover that you have rather less cranial development than... one might have expected.
Whereas you, on the contrary, have rather more than I had imagined, Professor. You will recollect, I am sure, however, that Beethoven's outdid us both. However, our personal characteristics are hardly relevant to the present situation. What have you really got to say to me?
Well, perhaps I only suggested, of course, perhaps it is a dangerous habit to finger loaded firearms in the pocket of one's dressing gown, Mr. Holmes.
Evidently you share that dangerous habit, Professor. I see that you keep your hand in the pocket of your morning coat. Supposing we lay our pistols and our cards on the table.
By all means. I was about to suggest it myself. Ah, I see you favor the Mauser type, Mr. Holmes, and without a silencer. You must permit me to present you sometime with one of these small devices of my own design. They're quite convenient in avoiding unpleasant noise, you know.
How very kind of you, Professor. You must ask the hangman to deliver it to me as your last request.
You evidently don't know me, Mr. Holmes.
On the contrary, I think I know you better than you know yourself. I wouldn't take up your gun again, Professor. I've already got you covered with mine.
So I perceive, but I assure you it was only to give a harmless demonstration.
Of the silencer?
Of my own small accomplishments as a marksman, Mr. Holmes. I've read in those accounts of Dr. Watson, that somewhat bovine...
I beg your pardon?
No doubt amiable friend of yours, that those marks on the wall there are made from your indoor revolver practice.
Quite so. The initials there, V.R., Victoria Regina, God save Her Majesty.
Now that I see them, it seems perhaps they're not quite as symmetrical as they might be. One side of the V is a little short, I think. Permit me to correct the slip.
Admirable, Professor Moriarty. You were perfectly right, of course. That little mistake has now been rectified. I would like, however, if I may, to improve upon it. Your bullet mark is perhaps a shade smaller than my own. Permit me...
Admirable, Mr. Holmes.
Yes, precisely above your own mark, Professor. The exact spot, I think. No, no, pray don't look alarmed. My good landlady is quite accustomed to that noise. We shall not be disturbed.
I'm very glad of it, for what I have to say is not without importance, Mr. Holmes. Shall we stop our fencing and begin?
By all means, if you will permit me first to correct one statement that you made just now.
Well, sir?
With reference to my friend Dr. Watson. I'm afraid I can hardly permit the adjective bovine.
Oh.
In his accounts of my humble exploits, he's been good enough to exaggerate my own achievements and has always been unduly modest about his own. He is a most upright and honorable gentleman, Professor, and very close to my heart. You may say what you will about me, but I can allow no derogatory words about him.
Very well, Mr. Holmes. I apologize. We who are about to die salute him. At least you do.
You are very certain, aren't you, Professor Moriarty, that it is I who am going to die?
There is no other course, unless you listen to reason. The situation between us, Mr. Holmes, is becoming an impossible one. It simply cannot go on.
It won't, I assure you. For these past few months, I've been working to put an end to it all at the earliest possible moment.
And you have very nearly undone the careful endeavor of a lifetime, sir. Or at least have seriously threatened it. No, 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 don't move. Your pistol again. I'm only taking out my memorandum book.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
I find it recorded here that you crossed my path on the 4th of January, Holmes. On the 23rd, you incommoded me. By the middle of February, I was seriously inconvenienced by you. At the end of March, I was absolutely hampered. And now, at the close of April, I find myself placed in such a position, through your continual persecution, that I'm in positive danger of losing my liberty.
That was certainly the end I had in view.
Then you must drop it, Mr. Holmes. You really must, you know.
Not till after Monday, Professor. You know as well as I do that you've made a slip. One single tiny slip. For years I've been aware of you, Moriarty, at the center of your organization. Forgeries, murder cases, robberies. 1,000 crimes were planned by you. 100 agents carried them out. Your subordinates were caught sometimes, but you never were. And yet, you know, you made that slip. That single tiny slip. And you know as well as I do that it will destroy you. In 3 more days, my evidence will be complete. I shall have you exposed, brought to trial, condemned, and hanged. And you can do nothing whatever to prevent it. My will is inflexible.
And so is mine. 3 days, do you say? And before they're out, the end will come. One or the other of us must die, sir.
Quite so. The 5 minutes is up, Professor, and I must really ask you to excuse me. In the pleasure of our conversation, I'm afraid that I've neglected business of importance elsewhere.
Very well, then. Seems a pity, Mr. Holmes, that I've done what I could. I admit that it's been an intellectual pleasure, me to see the way in which you've grappled with this affair, but I tell you solemnly, Sherlock Holmes, that if you are clever enough to bring destruction on me, you may rest assured that I shall do as much to you.
You have paid me several compliments during this interview, Professor. Let me pay you one in return when I say that if I were assured of the former eventuality, I would most cheerfully accept the latter.
I can promise you the one, but not the other. Good day, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, your pistol, Professor. You may need it before Monday.
Thank you.
Good day, Professor.
I think goodbye is the word, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. Goodbye.
So it was, you see, Watson, that singular interview with the greatest criminal of all time.
And his with the greatest detective.
Oh, thank you, my dear fellow.
But what are you going to do, Holmes?
I told you, we leave for the continent. Moriarty's not the man to let the grass grow under his feet. Already 1 or 2 accidents have nearly befallen me today.
Upon my soul.
Yes. The police are gathering all my evidence against him. Everything will be complete in 3 short days. Meanwhile, I can only lie low. Are you able to leave your practice to come with me?
I have an accommodating neighbor.
Ah, dear Watson, I knew I could count on you. All right, then. Now, these are your instructions. Listen most carefully.
Instructions, Holmes?
I assure you they are most necessary. Tomorrow morning at 8:45, you will take a hansom cab.
I'll arrange for one to call.
No, no, you really must obey me to the letter, Watson. You'll leave the house alone tomorrow morning and take neither the first nor the second cab which presents itself at the rank.
Very well, Holmes.
Hand the address to the cabman written on a slip of paper and tell him not to throw it away.
And I'll drive, I take it, to Victoria Station.
On the contrary, you drive to the Strand end of the Lowther Arcade.
I see. And then?
Have your fare ready, and the instant your cab stops, pay him and dash through the arcade, timing yourself to reach the other side at exactly 9:15.
Yes, but my dear
Holmes... Now, listen, man. Listen carefully. It's vital. Our lives depend upon it. When you get there, you will find a brougham standing close to the curb, driven by a fellow with a black cloak tipped with red. Say nothing. Simply jump in, and he'll drive you to Victoria in time for the Continental Express.
And where shall I meet you, Holmes?
The second coach from the front of the train, a first-class carriage reserved for us. Good night, Watson. And as you value our lives, don't forget a single word of my instructions.
No, no, no. Of course not, Holmes.
Until we meet tomorrow, then.
Until we meet. I was infected myself with something of his own inner excitement and sense of menace. I took the hansom and then the brougham with its massive hooded driver. I said nothing to him, as I was instructed, and he never spoke to me. A moment later, we were rattling to the station. There he left me and drove off without a further glance, his face still hidden. There was no sign of Holmes, and my heart sank miserably. I found our reserved carriage, but through some confusion, a decrepit old Italian priest was sitting there. The moment came for departure. And still, I waited by the window in a chill of fear.
Scusa, signor. Pray go.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Padre. I don't speak Italian.
Nor do I, Watson.
Good heavens, Holmes.
No, quiet, man. This is no laughing matter. Not yet, anyway. There. See?
Stop! Stop the train!
It's Moriarty himself.
The tall man? He'll never do it.
Stop the train, I say! Let me go, you fool! All you're in you! Let me go!
Even the great Moriarty himself is helpless against the British railway system, Watson. Well, well, it gives us an hour's respite, at least.
But how did he know where we were?
By watching you, I expect.
But I did everything you told me. Wait, Holmes. The driver of the brougham.
Well, what about him?
He was muffled. I didn't see his face. It must have been one of Moriarty's men.
My dear Watson, it was nothing of the sort. It was my brother Mycroft, shaken for once out of his armchair at the Diogenes Club.
Good heavens. The thing is serious, then.
Of course. But at least we have an hour, and I can use it to take off this disguise and think things over.
But we've escaped him altogether, surely, since the train connects with the boat.
My dear fellow, you evidently don't realize even now that Moriarty is an opponent on practically the same intellectual plane as myself. Do you really imagine that if I were the pursuer, I would permit myself to be baffled by so slight an obstacle as an express train?
What'll he do, then?
What I should do, engage a special.
But it'd be too late, even then.
By no means. We stop at Canterbury, don't forget. And then there's always a delay of 1/4 hour when the train gets to Dover.
Oh, so you'd almost think we were the criminals to be chased like this? You mean that he'll catch us after all, then?
I hope not. We shan't be there, Watson.
Look here, Holmes. I hate to grumble after all this time, but really, I do think you ought to tell me what you mean.
Heaven bless you for a stout and faithful friend, Watson. I'm sorry. It's only that...
Well,
I don't want to expose you to danger, too. That's why I'm being so mysterious. It's very simple, really. We shall just get out at Canterbury.
Indeed. And not go on the continent after all, I suppose.
Oh, yes, we must do that. We've no choice but to hide away until after Monday, when the evidence will have been completed. You've not seen the papers this morning, I suppose.
Oh, really, Holmes. What time do you think I've had for that?
One must try to make time for everything, Watson. You really should have read about Baker Street.
Baker Street?
Yes, they set fire to our rooms last night. Mrs. Hudson was away from home, fortunately, and no one was hurt, I'm glad to say. They thought I was there, of course.
Upon my soul, the thing's intolerable, Holmes.
Yes, only till Monday, Watson, and by then we'll be in Switzerland. We'll make a cross-country journey from Canterbury and take the other boat from Newhaven to Dieppe. Unless, of course...
What?
our friend the professor deduces what I would deduce and gets off at Canterbury himself, that would truly be a coup de maître.
He surely never would.
Well, I rather doubt it. There are limits even to his intelligence. No, I think we are safe enough, old friend. And now there's time for a pipe, I fancy. Won't you join me, Watson?
And thus it befell. As we hid behind a pile of luggage at Canterbury, we saw the single carriage of the special go thundering past us. And so we made our way across country and at last reached Switzerland. It seemed we had eluded him. To fill in every detail of the final scene is hardly possible, since there was no witness to it. Yet, from a certain source that I cannot yet divulge, I do know something of that last encounter. We wandered at our will through the lovely valley of the Rhone and made our way by way of Interlaken to the little township of Mirrigan among the Alps. The fatal Monday came and went, and yet I was still aware of a strange, febrile excitement in my companion. He was at times feverishly on the alert, then sinking into reverie, and would smile strangely to himself. I went with him, on that last day of all, on a visit to the falls of Reichenbach, forever hallowed and yet cursed in my memory. It's a fearful place indeed, with a torrent plunging far below into a tremendous abyss, a chasm lined by coal black glistening rock. High above, a pathway has been cut in the cliff face to afford a better view, but it ends abruptly in midair, and the traveller has to return as he came. We stood there, giddily marvelling at the great spectacle, and on the instant came a message for me by a village lad to say that an English lady back at the hotel was seriously ill and needed my immediate attention. I turned to go. I looked back, and I saw Holmes leaning against a rock, with his arms folded, gazing down at the rush of the waters. It was the last I saw.
Is that you, Watson? Back already? Well, Moriarty.
Well, Sherlock Holmes. You see, I found you after all. And alone.
Alone, as indeed you must be too. Now that your confederates are all under lock and key, I heard from Scotland Yard.
I escaped. I was too clever for them, Holmes.
I don't doubt it. But I'm afraid your occupation's gone, Professor, with your organization destroyed, unless you care to return to your mathematics.
It was not my intention. I have another and more immediate intention, Sherlock Holmes. Are you prepared?
But before we discuss that, perhaps you extend me one small courtesy, Professor.
No, certainly. What is it?
My friend Watson, Professor. No doubt he will be somewhat concerned. May I just take a moment to scribble a note to him?
No, certainly. We can fix the paper beneath my alpenstock there so that it does not blow away. Pray take as long as you wish.
That's very good of you. Please, don't stop talking, Professor. I mastered long ago the art of writing and conversing at the same time.
Thank you. You know, of course, that the message which arrived for Dr. Watson was a false one.
Oh, yes, of course. I knew it at once. And that it could only come from one source.
And yet you let him go?
Yes, Professor, I let him go. I am not without some affection for him. I did not wish to put his life in danger, too. Besides? I've looked forward for a long time to this final duel between us.
I believe it, Holmes. You're a very remarkable man. In many ways. Many, many ways, sir. I'm proud to have known you.
Oh, and I you, Professor. There, my letter's done, then. Perhaps you'll be kind enough to place it, as you suggested.
Right.
Now, how shall it be, Moriarty?
I did not bring a pistol, Holmes.
Thank you. Your courtesy puts me to shame, Professor. Here is my pistol. It goes into the falls.
Hand to hand?
Yes. Goodbye, Professor Moriarty.
Goodbye, Sherlock Holmes.
When I returned to that broken pathway, it was only too clear what had happened. It needed no great application of Holmes' own methods of deduction. Two sets of footsteps to the verge, and none returning. Locked in each other's arms as they fought, they had gone down to the abyss. Only the letter, the last greeting, "My dear, dear Watson," he wrote.
"My dear, dear Watson, I scribble this through the courtesy of Professor Moriarty, who awaits my convenience for the final discussion of those eternal questions which lie before us. There can be but one outcome, although I fear that it is at a cost which will give pain to my friends, and especially, my dear Watson, to you. I think, however, that I may go so far as to say that I have not lived entirely in vain. Pray tell Inspector Patterson that the papers which he needs for a full conviction of the Moriarty gang are in pigeonhole M. Before leaving England, I made every disposition of my property and handed it over to my brother Mycroft. Pray give my affectionate greetings to Mrs. Watson and remember me as I used to be in our old days at Baker Street, pacing to and fro with my violin and driving you to a point of sad distraction with that theme you still were good enough to say you loved. Believe me to be, my very dear good fellow, yours most sincerely, Sherlock Holmes."
Yours most sincerely, Sherlock Holmes. And so he perished, whom I shall ever regard as the best and wisest man that I have ever known.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, based on the original stories of the late Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized anew by John Keir Cross, stars Sir John Gielgud as Sherlock Holmes, Sir Ralph Richardson as Dr. Watson, and today, Orson Welles as Professor Moriarty. Produced by Harry Allen Towers.
Safety PSA. No matter how you feel about current gun laws, everybody should know the most critical rules about handling any firearm. Rule 0. All guns are always loaded. Rule 1. Never point a gun at anything you are not willing to destroy. Rule 2. Keep your finger off the trigger until your sights are on target and you have made the decision to shoot. Rule 3. Be sure of your target and what is beyond it. A public safety message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
Okay, that was a little public service announcement from Digital George and Henry. Preceding that was the final problem. The original air date was the 10th of April, 1955, starring John Gielgud, as you heard, and Orson Welles. Well, I have too much more on that. I think John Gielgud played one more. There was one more episode of John Gielgud before he exited, and they started a whole new series, Sherlock Holmes series. That'd be 55. All right, much has been said about War of the Worlds. My brother-in-law, in fact, said, how do you have a radio show and play in radio dramas if you haven't played War of the Worlds? So I started doing a little snooping around about that infamous broadcast. And I'm going to play an interview between Orson Welles and H.G. Welles. This was aired on KTSA San Antonio on the 28th of October, 1940. I'll let Vic Mizzi play out here before I start it. This is Arthur. You're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford and or WMFO.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Charles C. Shaw speaking. KTSA is honored this evening by the presence in our studios of two great men, the Honorable H.G. Welles, world-famous British historian, author, and student of world affairs, and Mr. Orson Welles, the genius of stage, screen, and radio. This is the first time that Mr. H.G. Welles and Mr. Orson Welles have appeared together. In fact, they met for the first time only yesterday here in San Antonio. But this is not the first time that their names have been linked. 2 years ago, Mr. Orson Welles adapted Mr. H.G. Welles' book, War of the Worlds, for radio purposes, and you know the rest. Revising the story somewhat, Mr. Orson Welles depicted an invasion of the United States by men from Mars. Although he explained it numerous times during the program that it was fictitious, the country at large was frightened almost out of its wits. Men called radio stations offering to enlist against the Martians. Others were panic-stricken. The realism of the production, frightening though it was a tribute to Mr. Orson Welles' genius. And thus the name of Welles, H-G-W-E-L-L-S, and Orson W-E-L-L-E-S, became linked. Mr. H.G. Welles, in the opinion of many, is the world's most famous man of letters. He has come to San Antonio to address the United States Brewers Association, and Mr. Orson Welles is here for a town hall forum address Wednesday. In this meeting of great minds, I feel rather inconspicuous, and the less I have to say, the better you listeners will like it. But first, could I interest you gentlemen in a discussion of Mr. Orson Welles' broadcast of Mr. H.G. Welles' book, The War of the Worlds?
You're turning the meeting over to us, sir?
I am, for the moment.
He's turning it over to us. Well, I've had a series of the most delightful experiences since I came to America. But the best thing that has happened so far is meeting my little namesake here, Orson. I find him the most delightful carrier. He carries my name and an extra E that I hope he'll drop sooner or later. See no sense in it. And I've known his work before he made this sensational Halloween spree. Are you sure there was such a panic in America, or wasn't it your Halloween fun?
I think that's the nicest thing that a man from England could possibly say about the men from Mars. Well, Mr. Hitler made a good deal of sport of it, you know, and actually spoke of it in the Great Munich speech, you know. And there were floats in Nazi parades.
Much else to say.
That's right. Much else to say. And it's supposed to show the corrupt condition and decadent state of affairs in democracies that the War of the Worlds went over as well as it did. I think it's very nice of Mr. Welles to say that not only I didn't mean it, but the American people didn't mean it.
That was our impression in England. We had articles about it, and people said, have you never heard of Halloween in America when everybody pretends to see ghosts?
Well, there was some excitement caused. I really can't belittle the amount that was caused, but I think that the people got over it very quickly, don't
you? What kind of excitement? Mr. H.G. Wells wants to know if the excitement wasn't the same kind of excitement that we extract from a practical joke in which somebody puts a sheet over his head and says, boo, I don't think anybody believes that that individual is a ghost, but we do scream and yell and rush down the hall. Mm-hmm. And that's just about what happened.
That's a very excellent description.
You aren't quite serious in America yet. You haven't got the war right under your chins, and the consequence is you can still play with ideas of terror and conflict.
You think that's good or bad?
It's a natural thing to do until you're right up against it.
So it ceases to be a game.
And then it ceases to be a game.
Well, now, here's a thought. Some of Mr. H.G. Wells' writings are termed fantastic, and a few years ago, well might they have been conceived such. The Shape of Things to Come, which told of a long internecine war, was such a fantasy. But, Mr. Orson Welles, do you think that it's so fantastic in view of today's events?
It certainly is not so fantastic, and the one question that Mr. Wells has spoken of, not only in The Shape of Things to Come, but has hinted at or directly prophesied such a state of affairs following a wasting war and a return to a feudalism from which the world would find itself again. And today in Mr. Wells's lecture, he said quite the most interesting thing that I've heard in a long time. He said that he commenced just recently to ask himself if there was any reason why mankind should so emulate the phoenix and should so get itself out of its mess. He proposed a couple of solutions, but he did admit that there was a possible excuse for a gloomy point of view, mm-hmm. and that it would be good to be realistic about it and not to dismiss the gloomy point of view anymore. Perhaps the time had come to look ahead, since the future, Mr. Wells' future, which we've always adored and never really understood, is suddenly upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are living right now in that famous H.G. Wells future, which we all knew about.
Now, before we get away from this microphone, tell me about this film of yours that you've been producing. You're a producer, aren't you? You're
That's right.
Art director, you're everything.
Well, Mr. Wells,
what's the film called?
It's called Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, yes.
Citizen.
Not C-A-I-N.
No, K-A-N-E. And this
Kane.
Is, of course, the kindest and most gracious possible thing to do. Mr. Wells is making it possible for me to do what in America is spoken of as a plug. And he understands
the
fine old American
I don't it. Understand these words yet.
You understand the value, however. Mr. Wells wants me to tell you that I have made a motion picture, and he is kind enough to ask me a leading question concerning it.
I'm looking forward to it.
You're very kind, sir. It's a new sort of motion picture with a new method of presentation and a few new technical experiments, a few new methods of telling a picture, not only from the point of view of writing, but of showing it.
If I don't misunderstand you completely, I think there'll be a lot of jolly good new noises in it.
I hope so. I think a few jolly good new noises are what the motion pictures could well afford these days. I hope you're right, and I hope there are some jolly good new noises. I can think of nothing more desirable in motion picture. I'm all for some jolly good.
An interview with Orson Welles and H.G. Wells on KTSA San Antonio on the 28th of October, 1940. Interesting discussion there about the hoax and so forth regarding the War of the Worlds broadcast. Again, I'm going to build that up because Eventually, I have to play War of the Worlds. It goes without saying that I'm going to have to do that at some point. Having the time slot I do, and play the show that I do, radio dramas. This is Arthur. Vic Mizzi's in the background. You might recognize that from the Addams Family. I'm going to close out the show, the next DJ's in, with another treatment of The Broken Melody. This one's by W.H. Squire. This one was recorded in 1928. I found this at the AHRC Research Center for the History and Analysis of Recorded Music. I'm going to close out the show with a major HIPAA violation. I'm going to play my doctor, some of the poems, and him speaking about poetry. It's a rainy day today, folks. It's the 18th of September. Have a nice day. Thank you.
much depends upon the red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
Good for you. That's the poem. See, they like it.
I made one little mistake in it. I should have said a red wheelbarrow, but that's all right.
Maybe you better do it again.
So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
Now, what? Let me get right at that and find out how one happens to write that poem.
Well, I was writing a poem every day. I was writing something every day at that time, just to keep in practice. Every day I'd write at least 8 or 10 lines, sometimes 3 or 4 lines. And I suppose, as with most artists, or those who consider themselves artists, most of the work really is, as Mr. Freud would say, or Dr. Freud, subconscious. I say unconscious. It comes out. Now, that isn't the end of the work of art. Something appears, something comes out, and you have a sensation of pleasure in having written it. Perhaps that's egotistic, but at least it's pleasure, and after all, we all seek modest pleasure. That's why we marry, that's why we have children, and why we go on through life eating and drinking. And it's the same with art generally. So that I wrote that, and then, of course, I sat down to think about it.
And what did you think?
What did I think? I wondered what it meant. Until a lady from Boston, I should say Boston, wrote and said, Dr. Williams, that is a charming poem. But what in the world does it mean? And then I began to realize that it meant exactly the same as the first 2 lines of Endymion. A thing of beauty is a joy forever.
And a red wheelbarrow beside white chickens.
Glazed with rainwater. And you meet it also in the commonest places if your eyes are open.
Yes.
Isn't that a good meaning?
I know exactly what you mean.
Well, that's
fine.
And
lately I've come to the point where that is my philosophy of life, if I have one. These little moments, these little beautiful things of fragrance.
Quite true.
Looking out at the park, I live opposite Central Park, looking out at night when the lights are on or when there's a mist or when the new green of the leaves is coming out in spring or it tries, poor thing, to turn red and yellow in its city. They're city trees and they have a terrible time ever getting red or yellow. Did you ever think of that?
Very definitely, yes.
You know why? It's the smoke and the gasoline, I think. And maybe just the feeling of living in a city.
It's a common experience, but to put it into a form is the work of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
So that you and others are pleased when they see it and not baffled. In other words, don't think about a poem, read it.
That's right.
And when it's spoken, listen to it. Don't worry.
There's another one of your poems in later poems that I was reading last night. You said something about writing, that you have to write.
I think that is the disease of all artists. They have to paint. They have to play the piano like Sigmund Spaeth, or they have to put words down because it satisfies something. It's a confession. And we all want to confess, don't we? I think we love to confess. The church is founded on it. We have to confess, and you can sit down and confess to a piece of blank paper. You come away sometimes clean. Come away feeling better, relieved.
Clean, that's one of your favorite adjectives.
Yes, to be clean in your mind, not fuzzy. Definite, clear, like a diagnosis of a competent physician. He wants to look inside and say, what precisely is the matter? Not start twisting your leg first and then find out afterward that it's broken, but look and see.
Hmm. I noticed that word clean used often in your stories.
Yes.
And I saw why, too. Tell that amazing, I think your story is one of the best of all. You didn't want to be either a doctor or a poet, did you, to begin with?
No. I wanted to be a forester, to get away from human beings, out where I could be alone and clean. But I didn't succeed. Because there were no schools at that time except postgraduate schools, and one at Cornell and one at Yale. But I got into medical school without going to college by taking an entrance examination. I think there's a lesson there. I don't know whether Dr. Spaeth would agree with me. It seems to me men are getting into medical school a little too late. It wastes four, at least two good years of their lives when they could be competent physicians. And I think I was fortunate to be the youngest and next to the youngest man in my class. I don't feel that it was ever a barrier. I acquired some of the subjects that would have been taught in pre-medical school afterward by being interested and applying myself to them, such as languages and an understanding of literature and history and painting. I used to quarrel with some of the men who didn't think I had sufficient of a formal education, but I told them if they had perhaps a little better understanding of comparative anatomy, they would have been better businessmen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I heard such a charming little story, though, about your having an illness, and that was
true.
What changed.
Well, that really got me started writing. I suppose there was something there. I had been running on the Horace Mann High School track team in the 22nd Regiment Armory. We had no proper trainer, and I don't think I was very robust, and may have had a touch of rheumatic fever without knowing it. No one else knew much about it at that time anyhow, but I was running the quarter mile, and we went around the track, and I went into my sprint at the end, and then some fool said, "Another lap," after I was completely exhausted. Well, being obedient and law-abiding, I went on my other lap and came out of it sick and went home and was put to bed, what they used to call adolescent heart strain. Then they told me that I was very athletic at the time. I loved baseball, loved anything that would take me outdoors. I was told that the most I could look forward to in my life would be long walks in the country. And I, from that time, for about 5 years, I watched the other fellows go into the thing, and I sat down very definitely. So it was a shock. And then came along, you know, that horrible thing that everyone is afraid of, frustration. You've heard of it, you know, the thing that Freud popularized and which is so stupid. Everyone is frustrated, of course. We're all frustrated. Well, frustration was the greatest boon to me that ever happened because it started me on my proper career and my proper interests in life. I immediately started to look around. Do you want me to talk as long as this?
I do. I want you to go right on.
Well, my mother was a painter, an accomplished portrait painter. She had studied under Carolus Duran in Paris, and I was her vicarious atonement. That made her give up painting. I came along. That spoiled the whole thing. But there were paints in the house, in the attic, half-squeezed-out tubes, you know, such a romantic figure. I went up and started to squeeze them out and paint. But it wasn't for me. I played the violin like Sigmund Spaeth, who was the concertmaster at Princeton in 1905, he told me just now. And I was no musician. My fingers aren't right for it, or something. My mind, possibly. And I looked at sculpture. But then, you see, I was already studying medicine, and it's so easy to write. All you need is a piece of paper and a pencil, and you can become as great as Shakespeare. It's easy, nothing to it. So that with the back of a prescription blank and a good pencil in my hand, I could write anything I was capable of. Do you want to hear my first poem?
Yes.
A black, black cloud flew out of the sun, flew over the sun, driven by fierce flying rain. That gave me the greatest